Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. Let's dig a little bit deeper into the technical analysis tools that you used. You already mentioned that you do use them. Talk to us about some of your favorites.
All right. Well, the number one thing I look at is the chart of the S&P. If we're talking broad market here, so or stock futures, anything, I look at the chart of the underlying. But then we can go into a couple of other things. One is put call ratios. So, for the purpose of put call ratios, as far as predicting the stock market goes, we use what's called the equity only put call ratio. We compute that. The CBOE produces some data on that as well. But that's all stock options that trade. It seems like in any given day, there's a lot of option trading that has nothing to do with speculation. There's hedgers, there's spreaders, there's guys doing reversals and stock substitute and all that stuff. That's just noise. What you're looking for is when the put call ratio gets extremely high or extremely low, and actually then reverses, that's where your signals come. So I'll look at that. We keep pretty close watch on that every day. And our own computer, we buy our data raw from Genesis Data and from DTN, and then we process it ourselves. So I'm not really relying on the CBOE's summary of the data. We're actually calculating our own data, and we do make that data available to all of our subscribers of our daily services every day. Then the third thing I look at is I do look at market breadth, in perhaps a little bit different way than a lot of people do, but the New York Stock Exchange has things on it that are not stocks, so breadth is a dubious number there. But we have a great set of stocks. That's stocks that have options trading on them. So we obviously have that data. And so we look at that stocks only data for breadth. And then the last thing is volatility. So as I mentioned, volatility is very low right now. The 200-day moving average of VIX is sitting just below 17. VIX has not closed above 17 all this year. It's probed up there a couple of times, but hasn't closed above it. So to me, as long as VIX can stay below 17, I'm not too worried. I think stocks can continue to rally. But if VIX gets above 17, to me, that's a huge, bearish warning signal. And I'd be definitely doing something at that time. So So those are the sort of simple ones that I look at every day, and there's a few others that we add in there as well, but those are the basic ones.
I want to talk a little bit about the logic behind your trades. First off, what markets are you currently focused on in trading?
Yep, so we focus specifically on industrial commodities. We have two core products. One of them is a futures-only product, and that's exchange-traded futures. So it's markets like aluminum, copper, tin, nickel, zinc, lead, platinum, palladium, about 12 markets in total that we focus on. We also have another product, which is a commingled fund, which is about 60% futures, 40% equities. And within that fund, we get into some of the more esoteric commodities through equities, which don't have futures contracts, you know, things like beryllium, things like ferrosilicon, been involved in many, brought into the universe quite a bit. So just specifically, though, the industrial commodities complex.
Why those products?
Again, I think they're just interesting products where there are a lot of very, very large funds that may trade in like aluminum or copper. Oftentimes the funds are trading them based on, you know, inventory reports that come out, sort of different momentum-based factors, which are questionable whether they work or not. But if one really, really digs in terms of the supply and demand, in terms of what's really going on the ground, I think one can get an edge. And like, our edge is really twofold. Number one is we have a very broad network, both amongst myself. I mean, outside of the fund, I've been quite involved in terms of trading physical commodities as well. So know a lot of warehousers, a lot of miners, a lot of shippers from that. And then the other part of it is, use any source of alternative data that we can. I mean, what's working well right now is imagery. I mean, again, we're tracking 192 facilities around the world. We're looking at 9 different investment factors. And again, factors can be as easy and as simple as things like, you know, how many cars are there in a mine parking lot? I mean, you know, day after day, there are 35 cars, and then suddenly there are, you know, 115. Well, that's a facility we should probably look into. So it's sort of coupling, and the ideas come from really both. They could start on the physical side or from, you know, someone within our network alerting us to something, or they could also start on the data side of something we just see in the numbers.
I always ask everybody on the show what their edge is, and without asking you, you just told me your edge is you have a broad network on the physical side, and you guys are really good at alternative data, and you specifically said imagery. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. And, you know, that happens to be a tool that's working well right now. Again, who knows whether it's going to be working well sort of down the road. I mean, my background is I have, I'm always looking for strategies. You know, I came about through the business with, you know, defined edge arbitrage oriented strategies, which we, which we traded at Goldman Sachs. I mean, I had a strategy at one point in my career where I could predict with 81% accuracy what direction the S&P 500 would go over 1 minute. And I called it 1 minute hedge fund, and that worked very well. But eventually those edges go away. So the trick is really just to be reinventing oneself and just always looking for new opportunities or new sources of information.
Tim, you've already been a part of some really big product launches in your 6 years at CME Group, but the micros did over 310,000 total contracts on day one. Has to be the biggest product launch that I have seen in my 23-year career working as a trader or a clerk at CME Group. How do you compare the launch of the micros to other products you've launched at CME?
Anthony, I mean, we're ecstatic here at CME. My team is immensely thrilled with the success, but it really is a firm-wide success and a shining example of what CME can accomplish for our customers and for the market when we come together looking to deliver these types of products and provide greater access to our markets for participants. I can't share enough how excited everyone is here. It's truly fascinating to watch yesterday, you know, where we did put up 310,072 contracts across all four micros. With the S&P doing a little over 159,000, the NASDAQ doing about 92,000, the Russell doing just about 34,000, the Dow 25,000. I mean, those are amazing numbers on an individual basis, let alone in aggregate, doing 310,000. And when we look back at things like the launch of the E-mini S&P on Globex back in the 90s, you know, a few decades ago, the E-mini S&P did a little over 7,000 contracts its first day when it debuted on Globex. So to see the micro S&P 500 contract do almost 160,000 contracts is phenomenal. When you're developing products, a lot of hard work goes into it. It's always exciting going into launch day. I think everyone's always optimistic. We know things are going to be successful, but it's always a question of when and what does that runway look like. And I think it's safe to say yesterday's record performance in the micro E-minis exceeded a lot of people's expectations here at CME. I'm sure a lot of people's expectations streetwide.
Oh, no doubt. I knew this was going to be huge
but I had no idea it was going to take off this quickly. And I want to stay on the stats for a minute here because I'm curious to see how the stats of the micros are compared to the e-mini stats. So one of the stats that I was looking at when I was looking at the total volume was how the e-mini S&P was 51% of the total volume of the micros. The NASDAQ was 30%. The Russell was 11%, and the Dow was 8%. So I'm curious, is that in line with the bigger products, or did we see a change in percentages with the launch of the micros?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you look at it yesterday, the fact that the participation was reasonably dispersed amongst the four micros, that's great to see. Let's just call it half the volume in the micro ES and half the volume in the other three micros is great. When we compare that to the classic size or bigger size regular e-mini S&P 500 contract, year to date in 2019, that's about 65% of our futures volume amongst the four major indices at CME. And the NASDAQ is about 20% on the NQ, the NASDAQ 100 e-mini, when looking at the volumes, with the Russell being about 9% and the Dow being about 6% for the classic e-mini varietals. So when you look at the more balanced participation across the micros, I really think that speaks volumes to the interest in these smaller size contracts. And it's not surprising. You look at something like the NASDAQ 100, and that remains a very hot trade and a very hot topic amongst the active individual trading community, as well as the institutional community. So I think that's why we're seeing some outside size in the NASDAQ, as well as the Russell. When you look at the Russell, that is a kind of a US-based trade that I think market participants like to trade. There's a lot of price action in the small cap space. It has a different volatility profile than the NASDAQ and even the S&P. So I think the fact that we've seen this participation, I think, just reinforces the message and the thesis that there are a broader set of participants out there that are excited and coming to see me to manage your risk and to access the market.
Hey, everyone. I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account.
What is it about your strategy that you believe gives you an edge and separates you from other traders?
Yeah, so this is something I actually wrote about. It's been a while, but I have sort of a unique view on edge. I think the common wisdom in trading is if you don't have an identifiable edge, you know, you just won't make it. And I think if you're a really systematic trader, that's definitely true. You need to have something you can identify. But to me, as a macro trader, I kind of view it very differently. And early on for me, I heard traders talking about edge, and I noticed, you know, every investor I've ever met in the world claims they have an edge. And I'm not really good at math, but I know that's impossible. For me, I'm not comfortable identifying anything I do as an edge, at least not one I'm confident will last in the long term. Global macro is informed, you know, by a mental framework of the way the gears of the world are turning each other in a really complex system. Having an edge in macro is probably going to be fleeting. You know, I may understand parts of the system perfectly, but I might still be wrong about the system as a whole. I may be right about the system as a whole, but have a really flawed view of the components. It kind of lends to building like fleeting victories that'll boost your ego, especially if you're right for the wrong reasons. But if you get macro right for even a few years, you may start feeling like you have an edge and that you understand the way the system works, but you may not. You know, you may have been right for the wrong reasons. And because of all that, I'm not comfortable saying anything I have as an edge. To me, being a good trader is all about plasticity, you know, being able to change and adapt to your environment. And if I go out and say I have an edge, then in my opinion, I'm less likely to adapt to my environment. And as a macro trader, I think that's what I'm depending on. So I just think it's a fatal conceit, especially in macro, to outline an edge that you have, because to me it's going to end up biting you.
I want to give you an example. So if I'm somebody out there who owns a business and I want to get into making CBDs,
yes,
I would come to your platform and I would get credit approval, and then I would say, here's the quality and X amount and everything that I would want to buy, and I would be able to put a bid on your platform. So this would fit that need of that person who wants to get into this space but is not going to have the growing ability, but they want to go and buy it at the market.
Right. Well, yes. And in this particular case, you would actually be buying semi-processed, right? The raw material for your CBD products. So you'd come to us, you would pass our vetting process, and then you would get on our platform, and maybe for some products, you can take the crude oil and turn it into CBD products. For others, like maybe a tincture, you would need to buy a further refined product like isolates or distillates. So consider it the raw material.
Yeah.
So it's like wheat for a flour miller, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. How much demand have you had for this?
Off the charts. So for it's a U.S. Usually we've been looking at niche markets where there are maybe 50 to 100 players tops, but in the this is all of the United States, and for now at least. I mean, we're talking about potentially 2,500 physical players. That's true physical players, no brokers. You need to be able to either, you know, show up with a truck or process a truck that's showing up at your door. That's how we define our addressable market there. So that's a lot bigger than even in world grains. You would typically find, you know, your big five and then a second tier of 20 or 50 players there. So about 2,500 for these semi-refined products, I would say, in hemp.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely.
And growing, I should say, and growing.
Dr. Haymeier, what I'd like to do is, I know many of our listeners are already, they know some things they could be doing. You know, we've talked about, you know, eating better. You've mentioned exercise. Sleep, I think, is something that's also very, very important. But they're not doing it. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that they're not doing it? And also, what could you tell them to help them take that initial step?
Yes, I love those questions. So, Anthony, the first thing that I would say is get out your pen and paper and actually get it out right now, or pull up a Word document, you know, truly, whichever one you prefer. And I'd like you to start to write down, first of all, what is your idea of optimal health and vitality? What is it? And what is it you don't have that you want? So you can get very clear about what it is that you want that you don't have. And then the next question I want you to answer is, why is that so important to you? Really, why is that level of vitality and health so important to you? And I even invite you to go to kind of an uncomfortable place and think about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, if nothing changed in your health, if the trajectory just continued, what would that be like? You know, really, would that be really awful? Like, would you even get to be here? And actually let yourself go there emotionally. And then the other thing I'd invite you to consider is, if you think about how you want your health to be, what would your experience of life be like if you had that? Like, what would it be like walking down the street feeling like that, or sitting at your desk doing that, or the level of productivity and accomplishment you could have in your life that you can't have right now? What would it be like to have that? And I think those two pieces are a great place to start. because once you're pretty darn clear about what it is you must have in your health that you don't have, and you really let yourself become aware of what it's costing you and what would become available if you had it, then you can start to think about, okay, what is the next step I could take to get myself there? And there is no such thing as a small step, right? Really, I'm such a fan of starting where you are. I want you to start where you are and take that next step and then take that next step, right? It's constantly just take that next step, but also playing the game of continuing to keep alive for yourself both your vision of health and vitality, as well as your why. Your why. Why must you have that?
Ira, are we headed for a recession?
Anthony, it's people ask me that question, and I don't like to get into that argument because I don't know how to define it, and I know that's not what you're looking for. Are we looking into an economic slowdown? I think so, yes. I thought that Trump would was looking to bail this out with a huge infrastructure program, but now he's willing to put that on hold to play politics with it. So I think we're going to go to a slowdown. Is it a recession? I don't define it by two negative quarters of GDP. That's not the way I look at it. If we were to slow down and jobs were stopped growing and actually unemployment started to go up, even though we didn't technically get into a recession, we're in an economic slowdown. Let me turn it another way. People said, oh, Germany avoided a recession because they avoided that second quarter of negative growth. They had 0.1. Well, what is that? You know, such a silly definition.
Yeah.
It's such a silly definition. But the media needs to sell a headline. If it bleeds, it leads. A recession bleeds, so it leads. I'm not of that ilk, but I think we're going to go into somewhat of a slowdown here.
You say that you can't define it, or you don't want to define it by the consecutive quarters of negative GDP.
Right.
But.
Right. Yeah.
What would be a way for you to define it? And you and I have talked about this before. Is it the inverting of the 210 yield curve?
Well, that would come beforehand, and I don't think we're going to see that. It need not take place because the Fed could actually, and they're talking about it, they could steepen the curve by front-loading all their purchases, everything the Fed buys, to within 0 to 2 years, and that would leave the back end much more subject to market forces, and they would be controlling the short end. So, which would result in a bull steepener, which I would kind of like to see. In fact, I'm trying to set myself up for that. It's been a very arduous trade, but that's what the Fed would have to do, and it would take the Fed admitting that they've been wrong about many things. And, you know, that's not easy for policymakers, and especially those who come from the academic world, to do. They don't like to admit that they're wrong. There's always a Steve Leisman counterfactual to bail them out. But, you know, I'm a trader and I'm an investor. I don't have that prerogative of counterfactuals. I have to react to what is. And that's what I have to do. I can't wait for X amount of time. You know, the classic definition of a recession is from the National Bureau of Economic Research, the NBER, which is two negative quarters in a row of GDP growth. But that's backward looking anyway, so that does nothing for me. Nothing for me. So if I'm predicting a recession, I'm loading up on things that I think are going to respond to it.
So you mentioned that you believe that we are headed for an economic slowdown, though. So how do you go about trading that?
Well, you know what? I think what you're seeing is, like, some people are getting short copper, because copper, that chart has turned dismal very quickly. And it's just not with the Chinese tariffs, because the response of China to the tariffs is, of course, to ramp up their own domestic spending. So that should actually help the copper prices. So something, I think people are using the copper as a derivative to make a play on a slowing coming, slowing economics. They see it in Europe. They see China slowing down a little bit. And of course, when China slows down, until you get the stimulus, it affects a lot of other places. And I think that's where copper is playing out, as well as the Australian dollar. The Australian dollar, because it's so natural resource-based economy and has been such a great story for quite a while, based on the growth that China has done in Asia, I'm looking at, well, now the Australian dollar actually turned higher, but the dollar has turned lower across the board. But we have a fairly weak Australian dollar, and that's with a very positive election result over the weekend, meaning that you got a very pro-business government, and it was not expected by any pollster. So it was quite a surprise to the market. And yet the Australian dollar still remains fairly weak.
Explain to everybody why you think they should be looking at oil when it comes to knowing what's happening with the economy.
Because oil is the economy. Energy is the economy. This is something that I realize is sort of deeply contrarian. But if you think about it, it's totally logical. My first degree was in history. And so a lot of my orientation is aligned with, well, you know, how did human society and economies evolve? And the constant in all of that, from hunter-gatherers to the present day, is that we work. And what is work? Work is expending calories to produce some outcome. And we used to pay somebody to do work for us if we had the resources and either didn't feel like doing it ourselves or weren't good at it. And today, most of the work is done by oil. And so money is nothing but a call on work. It's a proxy for work. And that has not changed over how many thousands of years of recorded history. But somewhere along the line, people decided that the economy runs on money. And so a lot of very knowledgeable and serious investors, and economists particularly, somehow lose sight of the underlying component of energy that is so fundamental to all economies. And I mean, I hear people talking about, you know, equity markets and inflation and central banking monetary policy and all sorts of, you know, modern economic theory. And I hardly ever hear any reference to, well, yeah, but what about the underlying availability and cost of natural resources, of which oil is the master resource, at least for now, and it has been for at least a century and will be for some time, no matter, you know, how optimistic you are about, you know, getting off of oil or whatever.
What is the price of oil telling you right now about the U.S. economy?
Basically, the price of oil right now is about where it should be, both WTI and Brent, and I can explain why I say that, but let's just for now say, you know, that's where it should be based on just sort of market clearing costs. Frankly, I think the price of oil is too high, not just for the U.S. economy, but the global economy. There's not a thing in the world that we're going to do about that. But I listen to economists and bankers talk about, you know, how frustrating it is that we can't seem to get ourselves as a country or as a developed world or a world to break out of this sort of low economic growth narrative that we've been in, certainly since 2007, 2008, and probably before that. And to me, it's real obvious why. And that is that the real cost of producing a barrel of oil, I mean real in terms of 2019 dollars, is, you know, roughly double what it was at the beginning of this century. So if your underlying cost of doing business, and I'm talking about manufacturing, distribution, marketing, if it's all dependent on some cost that has, let's just say, doubled, well, it's really hard to make any money, which doesn't mean that nobody's making any money. But you know, taken as just a leveling factor across the board, it's just who in the world can tolerate a doubling of underlying costs and still make money? I mean, that's I'm not saying that's the only problem, but that is a glaring problem that most people seem to not understand or ignore. I mean, most people say, oh, well, the price of oil is cheap right now. I mean, gosh, it was $110 a barrel 5 years ago, and it went down to 45 or 50, and now it's kind of, you know, in the 60, 70 range. So compared with what it was, it's cheap. Well, okay, fair enough, but investors understand discounting. And if you discount all of that, you understand, well, yeah, I mean, oil at $110 was prohibitive. So the fact that we're down to 70 is better, but it's still not good.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.